5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all of your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments, so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
This is DeRay, and welcome to Pod Save the People. On this episode, it's me, Miles, Kaya, and DR talking about the news from the past week with regard to race, justice, and equity that were underreported. We talk about everything from the White House to college basketball to health equity. We talk about a lot of stuff. Here we go.
Pod Save the People is brought to you by America Dissected. Picture this, you're pregnant, and because of your race, your risk of dying in childbirth is quadrupled. Lucky enough to make it through the pregnancy, your baby is twice as likely to die before their first birthday. This is the terrifying reality facing Black moms and babies worldwide. But why? Unfortunately, there's not one simple answer. It has to do with an endless list of societal factors: job access, housing, air quality, stability, and more. On last week's America Dissected, Dr. Abdul El-Sayed shines a light on these issues and arms us with information that could help change those statistics. The episode is out now. Make sure to listen only in the America Dissected feed.
Family, welcome to another episode of Pod Save the People. I am Diara Ballinger. You can find me on Instagram at Diara Ballinger.
I'm Miles E. Johnson, a.k.a. Cowboy Johnson. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram and TikTok at Feral Rapture.
Woo, Cowboy Kaya here at Henderson Kaya on Twitter.
This is Dre at Diara Ballinger.
Starting off real quick on, you know, today's happenings and Donald Trump's legal troubles and battles. You know, always something in the news about all these multiple criminal and civil cases that are pending against Donald Trump. But as of last Thursday, he lost back-to-back court rulings and separate attempts to dismiss indictments against him in two of his four active criminal cases. So in Florida, the judge there rejected his bid to drop charges related to his alleged mishandling of classified documents. Y'all remember those classified documents that were in bathrooms and everything like that in his house?
Yeah.
And that ruling came down 2 hours after Fulton County Superior Court judge denied Trump's request to dismiss his Georgia election interference case on the grounds that it violated his free speech rights. So just the fact that his lawyers are making so much money off of these foolish, foolish defenses is just beyond me. But that's the latest and greatest. Losing, and owing a lot of people monies. That's the current status of a lot of people's Republican nominee for president of these here United States.
Do you think that these lawyers think that they're going to get paid? Because this man has some financial problems, right? And all these billable hours are racking up. And so
that is a miraculous question, honestly. Yeah,
but those billionaire friends keep paying bills.
That's true. That is
but
true.
But I think they've been tightening those purse strings because they're just like, how much is enough?
Them gold sneakers are paying for it. Them $60 Bibles is paying for the lawyers.
$59.99.
Wait, okay. He's hosting a fundraiser today at Mar-a-Lago, and the price of admission is $800 large, $800,000 to get into his fundraiser, child.
I don't even know. Is that the street term for 1,800 large? I was gagging at $800, $800,000.
$800,000.
Whoa. Isn't the street term? Oh, that was good.
But did you see that Tish James, you know, because remember that billionaire?
Yes.
Filed the bond in
yes,
New York
the auto
City
the auto dealer or whatever he is, used and, car and, salesman.
And she went to court like,
she
let's
said it's
make
not
sure
legit.
You got the money.
It's not Come legit. On. But I love. I mean, Tish James, keep giving it to him, sis. Give it to him. Whatever law school she went to, can we all just make a little donation to thank them for preparing her so well? Good grief.
I will say that, like, I know this goes without saying, but there is no Black person in the history of this country who could openly commit as many crimes as this man, do it in public. Like, I even think about the gag order that he got against not talking about the judge. So then he attacked the judge's children and then said that the judge's children were not included in the gag order. And the DA had to say, you're right, we didn't write the judge's children in. There is no world where if anybody else had done that, they would just be in jail. They'd be, you know, forget what was in the gag order. Mm-hmm. They would have just arrested that person. But he does it on TV and people are like, let's amend the gag order. Like, what?
Crazy.
Yeah, I think it's also just not just his whiteness. I think that it's just how many people are interested in keeping him politically powerful, because he will do and say what you want him to do and say if the price is right, you know. So I think that that it's somebody who's just, you know, immeasurably valuable to the far right, conservative, whatever, blah, blah, blah name they're using for themselves now. I call them supervillains.
Well, speaking of supervillains, the saga continues in Gaza. So we got news over the weekend that the IDF deliberately murdered 7 humanitarian aid workers that were with World Central Kitchen. These are young folks who had been going country to country serving thousands upon thousands of meals, whether that's in hurricane, whether that's in COVID. They raised their hand to go to Gaza to serve meals and were so prominently dressed in the vehicle they were in, they were on a humanitarian route. All that to say, what all the news reports are saying, what Jose Andres, who is the founder of World Central Kitchen, is saying, is that these folks were deliberately targeted and killed.
Yeah, that they coordinated. This was something that I learned in this, that they coordinate their transportation with the IDF. Like, they let them know, hey, we're moving from here to here on such and such a date, so blah, blah. And so all of this was a very coordinated effort, and the IDF knew who they were, what they were wearing, what kind of cars they were in, when they were moving, and still, and like, not like boom, 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 took out 7 cars or so, right?
I don't know if you saw, but today Israel fired 2 soldiers and
Shall
said that,
yeah.
that
they did it.
Come on.
They did it by themselves. No, come on.
And I was like, not these 2 people being, and fired is probably loose. They probably got reassigned somewhere. They're just not in the army no more.
Yeah.
But also the assignment has been to kill. I mean, this isn't the first time that like humanitarian aid, like delivery was targeted. Like it continues to happen. I think the difference here is you have such a globally known figure like Jose Andres, who has a global platform to call them out on it. I think that's why there's accountability in this particular instance. But I mean,
yeah, because something like 200 and over 200 humanitarian aid workers have been killed so far.
Yep.
And this is the first that we are really hearing about that.
And they've been signaling very clearly to me, like, there's just no other interpretation of this than they're signaling that anybody who is helping the Palestinian folks is seen as an enemy and you're putting your life in danger, which helps the genocidal mission if you're making sure that people do not come and are able to feed people and help people. Then you're making sure that these people die, starve, and you're, you know, just kind of signaling that even your I don't know if you would call it your non-political, just humanitarian help will be met with blood if you come and help. It's truly disgusting.
And you know, the other thing that's been happening in Israel over the weekend is that thousands and thousands and thousands of folks have been protesting all weekend long, both in terms of wanting to get the hostages back and also basically saying that that Netanyahu is not representing the Israeli people in his action. So I think it's also something that we need to presence. It's actually like what the people of Israel, what populations in Israel are saying about this war and how it's not really led to anything in terms of bringing folks home. It's just been death on death on death. So the other thing that developed sort of out of this story is President Biden calling for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. So that was as of April 4th, according to The Guardian. They had a phone call where they talked about the 7 employees of World Central Kitchen that were killed. And it was a 30-minute phone call, and evidently President Biden made clear the need for Israel to announce and implement a series of specific, concrete, and measurable steps to address civilian harm, humanitarian suffering, and the safety of aid workers, the White House said in a statement. He made clear that U.S. policy with respect to Gaza will be determined by our assessment of Israel's immediate action on these steps. Biden said that an immediate ceasefire is essential and urged Israel to reach a deal with Hamas without delay. The statement marked a sharp, this is the Guardian saying this, not me, but I agree. The statement marked a sharp change in Biden's rhetoric and suggested for what appears to be the first time that strings could be attached to continued U.S. support. Bada bing, bada boom. That's where we are, y'all.
I hate to always say, like, I hate to be the person to say, like, too little, too late when it comes to stuff, but this feels like the most appropriate time to say too little, too late. It's kind of wild that this is what it took. I have news and internet brain, so I apologize, but I just know there was so much about Biden being very vocal about that not being a possibility for the ceasefire. And I'm also wondering how much, I don't know the timeline on stuff, because again, I have everything kind of collapses on top of each other in time for me in my head, but I wonder how much this is like also like politically motivated, like seeing what happened in Massachusetts. Wasn't there like a swing of protest votes that happened? So like I'm wondering how much that motivated also this ceasefire. And it just feels so late and almost like a little bit disrespectful. There is so much bloodshed. Mm-hmm. There's so much has happened. And this is what people asked you to do months and months and months ago, and just out of good faith, because now you're still asking somebody to do. I don't know. It's truly gross how America has been handling this crisis, this war, this genocide.
In better news, it is basketball time, y'all. It's the Final Four. Whoop whoop! I know nobody on this podcast cares about this.
I'm over here like Serena Williams. As much as I do.
But 12 million people watch the women's. I'm telling y'all, when I am your sports girl, we are all in trouble. But 12 million people watched the LSU Iowa game this past week. And it is the highest number of people who've watched a women's game like in history. Caitlin Clark versus Angel Reese and the girls, and LSU fell to Iowa. It was a great, great basketball game. Like literally basketball fans across the spectrum, men, women are like, this was the best basketball we've ever seen. And for the first time in history, men's final four tickets, women's final four tickets are like, are super much, like, I don't know what a number is. I heard something that said that like entry level men's final four tickets were $65 and entry level women's final four tickets are like $465, something like that. So girls in sports, it's our time. I just need the WNBA to start paying these girls. But I think one of the disturbing things that happened was the continued vilification of Angel Reese and Flajanae and the Black women who, you know, talk trash, play hard. I mean, Caitlin Clark talks trash and plays hard too, but they set the whole thing up as a good versus evil thing. And like, these are young women, like, you know, whatever, 18 to 22 year olds. And I think it was the LA Times that did a really trashy piece about, you know, good versus evil and just criticizing this young woman. And I don't know if you saw the clip, but, you know, Angel Reese cried at the, you know, at the press conference because you are 21 years old and the world is piling on against you.
I don't really get to stand up for myself. I mean, I have great teammates. I have a great support system. I got my hometown. I got my family that stands up for me. I don't really get to speak out on things just because I just try to ignore and I just try to stand strong. Like, I've been through so much. I've seen so much. I've been attacked so many times. Death threats. I've been sexualized. I've been threatened. I've been so many things, and I've stood strong every single time. And I just try to stand strong for my teammates because I don't want them to see me down and, like, not be there for them. So I just want to always just know, like, I'm still a human. Like, all this has happened since I won the national championship, and I said the other day I haven't had peace since then. And it sucks, but I still wouldn't change. I wouldn't change anything, and I would still sit here and say, like, I'm unapologetically me. I'm going to always leave that mark and be who I am and stand on that. And hopefully the little girls that look up to me, and hopefully I give them some type of inspiration that, no, hopefully it's not this hard and all the things that come at you, but keep being who you are. Keep waking up every day. Keep being motivated, staying who you are, staying 10 toes, don't back down, and just be confident.
I mean, we got to stop this. I was looking at my Facebook feed from literally a year ago, and I reposted a similar post where she had been vilified and called all kinds of names because she is, you know, a trash-talking, aggressive, good-ass basketball player. Y'all better cut this stuff out. Okay, sorry. I just needed to get all of that out. We can carry on.
You know, there were some sports commentators who said about the Angel Reese press conference, like, you know, you can't, you know, bark big and then come on here and cry and da da da. And if you watch the press conference, the moment where she tears up is actually when Flajanae defends her. She didn't like, she didn't walk in crying because they lost the game. Flajanae is like, y'all do not talk about Angel. Y'all don't know what's going on with Angel. Like, she gets emotional because of the love and care that is at the table with her. And people don't say that about those football players who cry when they lose the Super Bowl. They don't say that. You know, I've watched all these clips on Instagram of these basketball players, these guys who like tear up at their last game and this is literally, people talk about how emotional men are and it, you know, the game is the game and She tears up because her teammates love and respect her. And people act like it's the end of the world. I mean, come on, y'all. It was a great game, though. That was a great game. And I'm happy that they already have their championship because Caitlin Clark was on fire. And if Angel Reese hadn't messed her ankle up, because that little 2 minutes she was out the game, that was the game. So
I'm so glad you watched it, DeRay. Come on, friends.
I didn't watch Juju. I was like, you know, I was late in the night, but I did watch Angel and Caitlin.
Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Stay tuned. There's more to come.
I'm starting with the news this week, and my news is about kidney transplants. We've talked about medical issues before on the podcast. I'm fascinated with this. is there has been a push over the past couple years to take out race-based algorithms in the medical field. I remember when I first read about this, it was because of the podcast. I didn't know there were race-based algorithms in the medical field. But in 1999, there was an equation that is used to evaluate kidney health based on how quickly a waste compound called creatinine gets filtered from the blood. And this has existed before 1999, but in 1999, that was adjusted to modify Black people's results compared to everybody else's. And it was based on some studies with small numbers of Black people that were not representative and a false theory about race-based differences in creatinine. Creatinine is what's called creatinine levels. And until recently, that meant that Black people and white people would get two different results. And what that meant functionally is that Black patients, it would overestimate their kidney functions by as much as 16%. Now, this means that there were people excluded from the transplant list because the results said that you didn't need a transplant as much as other people needed it, or that your need was different because this was a racist algorithm. And between January 2023 and mid-March, more than 14,300 Black kidney transplant candidates have had their wait times modified by an average of 2 years. That is wild. More than 2,800 of them have actually received a transplant, as in they got moved up the list because they got bumped down the list because of the racist algorithm. So in the article, they recount these stories as a woman who is now out of college. She should have gotten a transplant when she was in college, but the list moved her. The article opens up with a story of a woman who gets a letter being like, hey, just kidding, we messed up. You now are going to get a different spot on the list. And I bring this up here because there are so many people and who, you know, why would you even quite, you sort of are like, you're on the list. Your doctor tells you this is where you are. You're like, the list is the list is the list. And then your whole life is uprooted. There are all these things, but you could have actually been a recipient of a transplant much sooner. And remember that Black people are three times more likely than white people to experience kidney failure. And of the roughly 89,000 people on the list for a new kidney, about 30% are Black. So I'll stop there. I brought it here because I was fascinated by it. There was a lot of news I wanted to bring this week, but this was top of my list.
That's just wild, DeRay. When I was reading through this and even listening to you speak about it, it's just astonishing. I think sometimes because of media and because of news and even entertainment, we can be so fascinated with like the theater of white supremacy, specifically in historical context. So like the whippings, and we like have these kind of like long gone stories that about like what happened and the brutalities that have happened, that we kind of forget that we, even though the theater of white supremacy in current day is not as fantastical as it once was all the time, that it's still baked into the institution, because this, it feels directly connected to what we often talk about when it comes to Black mothers and mortality rates and stuff like that. Like, although people aren't being denied access to a hospital, right? Like those like horrible stories about people dying because they couldn't get to a hospital during segregation. Now, we're still dealing with this type of mutated form of white supremacy that comes in these little forms like this that you won't know about unless you research it. And I guess like my other thing is also too, and I say this all the time when stories come like this, is how necessary it is to have medical experts that are dedicated to exploring literally the Black body. I know we say in the academic sense a lot to exhaustion, but literally exploring the Black body, because we need people who are committed solely to understanding how the Black body works.
This is, it's shocking. And then it's not shocking, right? If you remember, we did a story a while ago about how in football, as the NFL is dealing with these brain injuries, they use a different standard for the brains of Black people and brown people. And so a lot of Black and brown football players were not benefiting from the settlements and the resources available for, you know, concussions and related brain injuries. And, you know, or we talked about the piece on thresholds for pain for Black women and maternal health. Just when you think that there's not like another way to screw us, there is another way to screw us. And the health piece is particularly precarious. Because, like, this is life and death for people. You know how many of us suffer with kidney disease? Anyway, sorry, I'm not saying anything that we don't know. I'm just registering my continued outrage as these health disparity issues pile on and pile on. And this is what makes the, like, whole, you know, slavery was over hundreds of years ago, get over it, we're all done. That's what makes this some trash of an argument, because every single day, you know, Black people continue to be brutalized by the philosophy and the strategies and, you know, the approaches that people were using before, during, and now clearly after enslavement. So no, we're not over it, because you're still killing us, you're still abusing us, you're still, you know, whatever, experimenting on us medically. So no, no, miss me with the get over it argument.
So I've been thinking a lot about disparities with Black men in particular when it comes to health. My friend group from law school, there's five of us, and we lost our last dad 2 weeks ago. So all of the five of these Black men, you know, died too soon. And three of them died very suddenly as well, including my dad. So I think what I've been trying to wrap my mind around is like understanding there are like systemic, societal, institutionalized racism and oppression that exists in this country. I like as intellectually, like I understand that, but I think from a very heart place, as Black folks, we tend to put things in boxes so we aren't so impacted by them. But I think what I can't help to do is understand that my dad isn't here because of the legacy of racism, et cetera, that exists in this country. And we all live with that for so many different reasons, but that's a really hard thing to try to settle.
My news is about Trans Day of Visibility. So in the last couple of weeks, there's been like a lot of talk around the Trans Day of Visibility landing on the same day as Easter. And a lot of it was, of course, invented, because we know that Easter is, let's say, a rolling holiday, and Trans Visibility was a day that was already established to be on March 31st. So it just happened that they synced up like that. But of course, that that instance was enough for people to really latch on and create outrage around it. So that's the news. I really got upset because as I was watching people talk about it, you would think I was getting upset like with the conservative people and their weaponization of it and stuff like that. I really got really annoyed with the whole event of this becoming mainstream media fodder for the left and or the right. Like, that's what I got really annoyed with. I ended up watching from the early 90s, like 92, this talk with X's Pimpil, and also a similar Delaney, who are these like great Black gay writers. If you don't know about them, please like research and do it and go into them. And similar, or Delaney really said something that really calmed me down, which I didn't really know about, but he was talking about in the early 90s, y'all, that gay was a term that he did not use. He always used queer, that gay was seen as a term that was mostly used by upper middle class white men. And queer was his designated term. And that kind of like, I did not know that. I didn't know that there was, for my generation, I'm 33, for my generation, there was a reclamation of queer, and there was a queer, and there was, we would call each other queer because we wanted people to see gender and sexuality differently. I did not know how old this argument was, but it made me understand even deeper that this is how we get to Fox News talking about, in The View, talking about trans day of visibility, where who cares? And I say that because I'm looking at the them Instagram page. There are Black trans people, both Black and Brown people who are dead. There's overdoses in the community that are atrocious. There's unemployment that are atrocious, housing crises that are atrocious, and it's just this weird thing that something so trivial like a holiday. That doesn't matter. You know, a holiday that doesn't matter becomes the center of trans conversation. And it really makes me think, oh, this started with a whole bunch of as well-meaning as possible, really white gay men wanting to infiltrate mainstream society. So it makes it seem as though our issues are about bathrooms, about holidays, and not about housing, not about overdoses, not about all these other crises. And it really minimizes it. And it really pisses me off. It really peeves me off. It really, whatever crooked allows me to say me's off, that this is the concentration of it. And I'm, of course, really upset with the, I don't know. I might be lying. I'm not really that upset with the right party. We know their game. They will take anything. They will invent stuff in order to have an enemy. They like that. They like creating an enemy and creating something that can create a cultural war. That is old as pie for them. What I'm really upset is that the people who are on the left, the people who describe themselves as leftists or liberals, participate in the dialogue, and that participation in the dialogue piles on and covers up the actual really tragic and tragic emergencies that are happening inside the community. So yeah, I wanted to bring that to the podcast because I think sometimes we can be so, I think we could find so much toxic existential catharsis in political arguments. And I think we could participate in them, not just because we think that we're right, but because also it feels good. And we don't understand how we're also allowing a type of distraction to happen from the very real dangers that are happening to a community. And hopefully there's somebody who's listening who maybe didn't think of it that way, who's like, oh, wow, my very participation in this is actually stopping from me figuring out that, oh, wow, why are more trans people dying from ODs than cis people? Why are more trans people homeless? Why are more trans people not finding work and employment? Why are more trans people showing up dead? All these different things that are happening inside the community that really can use the spotlight on The View. You know, what if that was the conversation on The View? What if those things were the conversation that happens on The View? I work in and out with a nonprofit called For the Girls, which helps get people reassignment surgery and also housing. And I'm like, what would have happened if on The View, instead of talking about a holiday, they talked about For the Girls? and made that the highlight, like that. But we don't think about that because sometimes just calling somebody silly or calling somebody transphobic is really the goal and the catharsis, which to me is really trying to appeal to a thing that we don't need appealing for. And yeah, I kind of went out around the world with that, so hopefully y'all came with me. but I really wanted to say that. And I don't know, something about that Samuel Delany piece and him really separating that made me see that, oh, sometimes we're having gay mainstream conversations, even if we're talking about trans things, and sometimes we're having queer conversations. And I think that, like, I want to be really intentional about having the queer conversation, because the queer conversation is saying that we're not involved in this mainstream heterosexual patriarchy propaganda machine, mm-hmm. and we're not interested in it. We're interested in saving our own lives and making sure that we thrive, and we're interested in that conversation. We're not interested in infiltrating. We don't care about Easter. You know, we don't care about the holiday. That's not what we're talking about. We care about this person's dead, this person's homeless, this person's on drugs, this person just OD'd, this person can't get work. That's what needs to change. We need a queer society, not one where everybody gets a day in April and June.
And I think, Miles, yes, thank you for all of that. And I agree. And I feel like, and this is from our conversation last week around queerdom being a liberating space. And actually, for the liberation of all Black folks, I feel like it is, you really want to be closer to the queerness of it all. So when I say that, I mean, even from the kidney conversation, it's like, where is the safety for Black bodies in within these institutions? And what does that look like? And it's really, I've been working with the Los Angeles LGBT Center. And we, a couple weeks back, did a dinner really just trying to build community and build awareness around all of the challenges that humans with vaginas go through, right? And part of what came out of that was how rare it is to be in a doctor's office and to actually feel safe in that doctor's office. And for that doctor to approach you and say, if anything hurts, let me know, because nothing is supposed to hurt. You're not supposed to be in discomfort, actually. And to and just how rare it was for the folks in this room to have had an experience like that, I think is just so telling about what's happening in this country. But what where we kind of landed on it was that, Miles, to your point, so many of these conversations are happening in these sort of like political vacuums, or they're happening in ways that like they're dog whistles, as opposed to saying, what are intersectional points between all these communities? Like in a political campaign, why do I have to be African American for that political candidate, and LGBTQ for that political candidate, and yada yada? Like where can we be having these conversations so that when we're talking about trans bodies, it's not separate and apart from when we're talking about movement work around Black bodies? You know what I mean? So I think, thank you for bringing this, because I think it's something that's been very, very top of mind for me, because oftentimes what happens when we do lead movements from these heteronormative perspectives, so much gets left out. So much gets left out. Amen, Miles. Or should I say a human?
Or should you say a them?
Them. Come on now.
That was well done. We can put that on. Yeah. We should put that on t-shirt. Amen. Amen.
Okay.
Miles, I'll just double click all the things to what you said. And it is interesting how, of all the things going on in the world, this took up a lot of space. I like kept seeing it. I'm like, we got a lot of real stuff happening, like actual real, not like you got to be plugged in to know, but like real, real. And people up here, like, you know, I saw people on Instagram being like, I think what Tyrese made a public post about, like, Biden needs to apologize. I'm like, of all the things happening in the world, you are making posts about, like, it just feels so nuts. And it does remind me of like the layer of transphobia.
DeRay, that is, I hope you don't follow present. Tyrese. Are you following
no,
Tyrese?
No, it was on one of his vlogs. It went viral. It was like, yeah. I'm like, why is like, forget the fact that Tyrese is a newsmaker, but why is he even, who has the time to make a post about this non-story? It just.
And Diddy's right there.
Right.
If you want to be brave and talk about a social issue, Diddy's right there. So if you want to be brave right about there. Somebody, be brave about Diddy, but everybody quiet.
It was so weird.
Thank you for bringing this particular perspective, Miles, because it, as an ally, I think oftentimes, like, I look at this stuff and I'm like, what am I supposed to do about this, right? But what I am supposed to do, you are very clear, is to lift the issues that really matter, to redirect the conversation to the things that are important. And so thank you for helping us understand what we're supposed to be doing about this.
Don't go anywhere. More Pod Save the People's coming.
My news this week is short, and it was going to be a rant about pettiness, but it actually has a decent ending. So let me just, but it's still worth raising, because in the, like, from the chapter of really, is this what we have time to focus on? I take you to the New York State Department of Corrections and Community Supervision. What a name. Who a couple weeks ago announced that all New York prisons would be locked down during the solar eclipse. That all prisons would be locked down from 2 p.m. to 5 p.m., which are the normal hours of outdoor recreation. That there would be no visitation on this day, and this is all for safety purposes. Now, in 2017, when there was an eclipse, there was no lockdown, there was no anything, but for whatever reason, this eclipse is going to be much more dangerous than 2017. I don't know. They said they were going to lock it all down. Turns out what happens at an upstate prison is one dude who said, hey, wait a minute, I need to view the eclipse for my religious reasons. And they said, okay, you can go out in the yard by yourself with some, we'll give you some glasses and you could go view the eclipse. And then five other people were like, wait a minute, I need to view the eclipse too for religious reasons. And it's not lost on me that the first inmate who asked for this particular accommodation, his name was Mr. Zelinsky. He was the first to request permission, and they said, okay, sure. We'll give you some glasses and you can stand out in the yard by yourself. And then when a number of other Muslim inmates and inmates who practice Santeria and inmates who are atheists also requested the accommodation, the prison official said no, shut it all down. And so six men filed a federal lawsuit against the department, arguing that not allowing them to see the eclipse violates their constitutional right to practice their religion. They said that the eclipse is a religious event that they have to witness and reflect on to observe their faiths. And this just, like, it just stuck in my craw, because if prisoners are usually outside from 2 to 5 anyway, and everybody around the country is rushing to different places to see this eclipse, like, this is just, we want to deny prisoners this small piece of humanity by not allowing them to see the eclipse. Well, the good news is that later on in the week, the Department of Corrections and Community Supervision settled with the inmates and are allowing them to view the solar eclipse. They're going to give everybody glasses. They're going to allow these folks to go out and practice their religions. And I just thought, you know, we go out of our way. We wonder why, when we incarcerate people and they return back to society, you know, recidivism rates are high and transition back is so hard. And it's because we continue to dehumanize people. This felt like such a waste of time and energy, and it just felt petty. And I wanted to lift it up because, you know, governmental agencies abuse people in big ways, like the kidney thing, but also in small ways every single day by just denying us regular access to things that make us human. And so I'm thankful to the six men who stood up for their constitutional rights and for their attorneys who pressed this out. And I'm thankful that the agency found its way to allowing them to practice their religion.
Kaya, I didn't know about the guy who got a yes, and then when other people asked for it, he got it. I didn't know that was the
boom
backstory to this.
Boom. But
goodness gracious, you know, when we say it's all about race and people say we're being dramatic, I always think we're not being dramatic enough, because it really is always about race. And to just extend what we said with Miles's news, just think about how much energy got wasted trying to deny people to see them, the sun, you know, like
the sun.
You're like, think about the lawyers involved, all the staff people, all the meetings, the hearings, the court, just like, y'all ain't got nothing else to do. It would have been easier to just say yes, but that's how motivated racism is. That's how motivated hate is. I mean, what in the world?
The only thing that I'll add quickly is just Mr. Zelensky, who was one of the folks that put the lawsuit forward to be able to see the eclipse. He says, "The sky is so innate to daily experience and we barely think of it. No one should miss seeing it transform. It's a view of reality we never otherwise get to see." And I just thought that was so beautiful and profound. Just wanting to see the sky. That's it. Y'all, I am continuing my theme of rest. And I want to thank you to the folks that reached out to me on the Instagram to give me some pointers about rest. Come on, y'all, keep it coming. And so I thought just with the conversation that was happening online with it, I would keep it going. And so I found this article in the Philadelphia Inquirer. Shout out to Philly. I love my peoples in Philly. But this article was about female creatives who essentially brought other Black women creatives together, artists, writers, curators, just to rest, restore. It was a bunch of non-action, but action for them, for their souls, for their spirits, etc. And this was inspired by Maya Angelou. And I just thought this was so beautiful. So essentially, there was in this article, and this article was actually written by two of the two women that brought this convening together. But they heard Maya Angelou's voice whisper to them that they needed to do something to collaborate on creating a writer's respite in her honor. And understanding that nothing like that existed for women in Philadelphia, they wanted to pursue it. The other part of this that I loved, and I actually want to like do a trip to Harriet's Bookshop in Philadelphia, Black owned independent bookshop.
Mm-hmm. That's good. There.
We've got to go back.
Let's go. Let's go.
They realized that nothing was specifically dedicated to supporting women's self-rejuvenating activities like reading, writing, rest, and retreat. And they pointed to a quote by Maya Angelou that when she said, "A day away acts as a spring tonic. When I return home, I'm always surprised to find some questions I sought to evade had been answered and some entanglements I had hoped to flee had become unraveled in my absence." Thank you, Auntie Maya. And they also, this article also talks about this piece in the Paris Review about Maya Angelou, where she spoke about renting a hotel room solely for writing and reflection. And so their vision was inspired by her transparency about the silent demands of creative practice. And they really believe that female writers need time and space for solitude, for solitude, for solitude. And so there they went off, they gathered poets, journalists, memoirists, musicians, foodies, editors, mothers, activists, and more. And they named this thing A Room to Write and Rest. It happened on March 1st and they had a ton of participants and they, you know, sort of activated the space with meditation room, flowers, workshops, a private chef, personal band, time for journaling, and of course, books and more books. So their mission was to cultivate a space that mirrored the multifaceted brilliance of Maya Angelou and the countless women like her who navigate various social roles, partners, parents, community members, and creators. Yeah, Janine A. Cook is the owner of Harriet's Bookshop in Fishtown, and Misty Soul is an artist based in West Philly. So those were the organizers of this. And please, y'all, reach out to us and correct us if we are wrong. And the last thing I'll say on this is that they talk about in this article, it seems counterintuitive that in order to create space for rest, more work needs to be done. But that is indeed the case. In their conversations moving forward, they've been asking themselves questions like, what can we make more easier? Who can we ask for support? How can we make the process joyful and sustainable? We know that the answers are coming simply because we begin to ask the right questions. Come on, sisters. So visit Harriet's Bookshop, but also read this article because I just found it to be so beautiful. And I am not alone in my quest for rest. So thank you all who are participating in this year's theme.
thank you, Diara, for bringing this. I have like 250 different things that I want to say. I'm going to try to say them. I was like writing the list while you were talking. So like, female writers are not the only ones who need rest and solitude. Let me just say that. Female superintendents, female CEOs, males, all of our people, everybody needs rest and time for solitude. In fact, I have a friend who is the leader of a very large national organization. And his practice, his rest practice and his creativity practice is that for 1 week a month, and I, you got to work at this. Maybe you could have 1 day a month. Maybe after a while you can get up to a week a month. He's a big willy, so he could do it. But for 1 week a month, he goes away and writes and thinks for a week. And, you know, this month he'll go to Toronto and the next month he'll go to Miami. And he just alternates between the two. He's got a hotel room at each place that is his, and that is his practice. And that's the way he keeps his ideas flowing. That's the way he is able to write religiously, because otherwise he's managing the demands of a multi, you know, billion dollar organization. And so I think we have to figure out, for me, it is vacation once every 3 months. I have to go away at least a week every 3 months. And now I try to at least be at my place in Anguilla a week every other month. But we have to work to cultivate these rest practices. I want to shout out three sets of people who are doing this work specifically for Black women. First of all, I want to shout out me, Kaya Henderson. Part of the work that I have done as a result of a fellowship that I won is creating a space for rest and reflection for Black women superintendents and nonprofit leaders in the education space. And we've done now two retreats so far where these women get to come together, put it all down. We deal with mind, we deal with body, we deal with soul. And what happens after these retreats is like, you know, there's one woman who her organization was, you know, a few million dollars in the hole. And after this retreat, like she closed out the year with like a $27 million surplus. And I was like, say what, girl, what? And she's like, the ability to step back, to get clear about what I was trying to do, to be in community with other Black women, you know, just it freed me from the cage that I was in and enabled all of these different things to happen. And so I use myself as an example because I think that each of us can create, you know, these women, you know, grabbed the bookstore and said, let's make a place here. I think in each of our own contexts, we can do that. I also want to shout out the Highland Project, which is run by Gabrielle Wyatt and is a group that invests in Black women, invests in us from a financial perspective, but from a time and rest perspective. And in fact, they gave me the fellowship that enables me to do these retreats. So shout out to Highland. And if you're not following the Highland Project, you absolutely should. And then I want to shout out one of my good friends, Katara McCarty, who's created the Exhale app, which is a meditation and relaxation app for Black women. Bump it. I'm going to shout out Octavia Rahim, who wrote Pause, Rest, Be. I want to shout out the Nap Ministry lady who, you know, has focused us all on sleep and rest. The Black Liturgies woman, Trisha Hersey. Yes, absolutely. The Black Liturgies lady, Cole, somebody. I can't think of nobody's name right now. Somebody, DR is going to fix me up. But I think we're in a moment. I say all of that to say, we are in a moment where Black women realize that we can't keep being the mules of the world, that we cannot keep working tirelessly and mercilessly for the benefit of others, as you know, Auntie Maya said. And I appreciate that we are prioritizing rest. And so thank you for bringing it to the thing, Diara, to the pod.
I'm always interested in the way that systems do enable or limit people's ability to access anything other than work. And I woke up this morning going back and forth with somebody about the role of truancy. And in places like Baltimore and D.C., there seems to be something going on with juvenile crime. And I wake up this morning to a presser where the state's attorney is like, you know what? They need accountability. Parents need accountability. And I'm going to work on accountability. So the truancy laws, da-da-da. So I'm texting back and forth with somebody and I go, they need help. They don't need accountability. They need resources. They need, and it made me think about my own parents who were 23 when they had me and Teray, 23, 24 when they had me and Teray. And, you know, I was joking with my friend that like, you know, my father couldn't afford a babysitter, but he did actually get a babysitter once and she burned our house down. And after our house burned down, we never that babysitter again. And my great grandmother moved in with us. And it was only because she moved in with us that we like had a stable, you know, we had dinner, we had, and it wasn't that he didn't love us. It was like, he didn't have the resources. But I think about even her, I look back and think about it and I'm like, oh, I get why Nanny was like, y'all going over grandma's house today. Aunt Sheena got y'all. Uncle Barry got y'all. Like people just needed time to themselves. And that is just harder to pull off for so many people because of the lack of resources. It's not that people don't care. And I look back now, I'm like, oh, I see why Nanny was snapping sometimes because she was, we were driving her up the wall all day, every day. And we didn't know, you know, we were kids, but like what hearing you all, hearing you talk about it, it made me think about how often people steal time as opposed to having time for rest. And there's a cost to stealing.
Yeah.
Like you, something happens when you hide in the closet for 10 minutes just because you got to pull yourself together or you stay in the car.
Mamas who sit in the car. Yeah.
You sit in the car for extra 30 minutes because you, or there's a temper tantrum and you're like, you know what? You can have it. You know, like, you want to intervene, but you're like, I ain't got it right now. And how do we build a world where people don't have to steal time to lay down, steal time to go to a party? The other thing I think about, and I don't know if y'all saw this, it went viral on TikTok and Twitter, but there's a city, excuse me, with a 24-hour daycare. And there was a video of a mom dropping off her kid at like 10 o'clock because she had work or something like that. And people were like, she doesn't love her kid. And everybody was like, you know, you just putting your kid over at your grandma's house. You know, like you just dropped your kid off at grandma's house. This is the same thing. She just doesn't have a grandma's house to drop the kid off at. But like, why would you not want the kid to be in a safe environment? The parents get a break. You know, like, why wouldn't you advocate for these sort of resources for community? Why would you be judging people? Because what is the alternative? Leave the kid in the house alone? Take the kid? Like, the alternatives don't work either. And this is actually a safe environment with adults who know what they're doing. And let's be clear, a kid getting dropped off at 8 or 9 o'clock, really, they just sleeping. Like, that's the, you know, this is, they just sleep. So it just made me think about the cost of having to steal rest.
Well, that's it. Thanks so much for tuning in to Bossy of the People this week. Don't forget to follow us at Cricket Media on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. And if you enjoyed this episode of Bossy of the People, consider dropping us a review on your favorite podcast app. And we'll see you next week. Bossy of the People is a production of Cricket Media. It's produced by AJ Moultrie and mixed by Vasilis Futopoulos. Executive produced by me, and special thanks to our weekly contributors, Kai Henderson, DR Ballinger, and Miles E. Johnson.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to get stronger just around the corner, so you can give everything you've got. Whether you want to crush a few reps before class with our expanded strength equipment or sweat it out on your way home from work, with over 2,800 locations, there's a Planet Fitness close to you, and most are open 24 hours. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends January 30th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
It's 2026, not 2006. Your antivirus shouldn't feel like a dial-up. Webroot Essentials protects your new and old devices without slowing them down. It scans 6 times faster, uses 33 times less space, and it's ranked #1 against Norton, McAfee, basically all the usual suspects. And right now, you can get an exclusive 60% off when you go to webroot.com/audio. Lock in the smarter, lighter, faster protection your devices deserve and get Webroot Essentials today. That's webroot.com/audio for 60% off.